This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield. The MAGA teens debacle last weekend demonstrated how vulnerable the press are to myriad social and political forces. In the MAGA affair, says tech writer Charlie Worzel, we should especially not forget the intervention of right-wing operatives. Worzel, who was between jobs at his alma mater BuzzFeed and his future gig at the New York Times, watched from home, tracking the various meta-narratives as the story blew up. Charlie, welcome back to the show.
Thank you for having me.
I want to begin on the second day of the uproar, when the media seemed to pretty suddenly reverse direction. How did that come to pass?
This was the result of a whole bunch of videos that emerged showing different angles. It sort of had a Zapruder film effect of showing that there was more than the initial video had shown. And the publication Reason picked this up and started putting this narrative together that there was more than meets the eye to this encounter.
And you said that as a consequence, some respectable journalists fell for bad faith arguments. Now, I read that Reason article by Robbie Suave, who could be described as a contrarian provocateur. But I think he was the only writer I read on the subject all week long who actually fessed up to having no idea what was in those kids' heads, that it was a stretch to impute racial hate or malice. Bad faith?
I don't think that the Reason article was written in bad faith. I think there is an element of delighting in the fact of seeing this new narrative that sort of showed the mainstream press as being maybe overreactive. But I think that the bad faith narrative was surfaced sort of at the same time by a lot of right-wing provocateurs and members of what I call the pro-Trump media. And I believe that these individuals saw an example of perhaps the press overreacting and used it to launch almost an equal and opposite campaign to bully and harass journalists into stating that they had made a huge mistake and to sort of illustrate the fact that the mainstream media has no credibility.
It was the Foxes, the Breitbarts, the Gateway Pundits, the Mike Cernoviches, who went off on the whole enemy of the people fake news thing. And you believe this goaded people into rethinking their positions, or was it just the fact of the new video and the new angles?
I think that there was an overcorrection from a lot of members of the media, and the sort of apologies for maybe, you know, getting the context wrong initially by mainstream journalists is then manipulated into the mainstream media apologizes for victimizing these young children who didn't deserve anything, for ruining their lives. That was sort of the narrative that was being put forward all across the far right corners of the internet, the online provocateurs and the message boards and the fever swamps. And it kind of, you know, trickles down to the bigger mass communication platforms, to Fox News, to Breitbart. As journalists in the mainstream media, we have to be very careful about the way that we portray and even correct ourselves. I thought that there wasn't a lot of nuance in the way people corrected. You know, they said, I was wrong. I mischaracterized the situation completely. And I didn't see a lot of, you know, we still need to be talking about these issues of white privilege and bigotry and, you know, polarization. I didn't really see that. Instead, I heard, I made a mistake. I wish I could take the whole thing back. And I think it's important to have the nuance, but not completely capitulate.
What you're just saying perplexed me that, well, never mind the details. You know, the facts may be a little murky, but the larger story is undeniable. So why be distracted by what the kids did or did not do? Can't we just focus on the racism that so infects our society? Is that the right take?
Well, I certainly think it's what complicates all of this, right? There were a lot of people who said we should take a lot more time before we share something that outrages us. We need to step back, take a breather. I agree with that to some point, but these other angles of the video didn't emerge until, in some cases, a day later. If someone sees something that is a perceived injustice and there's video evidence of it, as journalists, we have a real balance to strike, I think, because we shouldn't wait for 24 hours and ignore an important story. It's all about walking that line.
And I guess at some point it ceases to be about even the truth behind the events. It becomes just the latest battle in the culture wars, which raises the question of really how important was it? In my filter bubble, it was all-consuming. You know, my Twitter blew up, as I'm sure did yours, but is this story itself worthy of the attention that in our circles was paid to it?
That feels like almost an unanswerable question in the sense that these things all become important because a lot of people decide that they're important in the moment. In the aftermath to this, we're seeing a lot of people talk about how journalists use Twitter and the bubble focus that we all have being inside there. I think one of the fallouts of that is we all log on every day, and especially in the Trump era, we're sort of creating a narrative together. We're all living history and writing it as we go. And I think one side effect of all of that is we tend to see moments, even if they're somewhat small, as indicative of the bigger story, as a big chapter in this meaty story. And I think sometimes we do blow it up out of proportion, and then that becomes a story in itself, and it just sort of feeds itself.
Now, I mentioned in the introduction that you are at the moment between gigs. You've recently left BuzzFeed, and you're joining the New York Times op-ed page. So as a consequence, you didn't actually have to report on this thing. How would you have? And would you have screwed it up?
I was someone who initially, I didn't add any commentary to it, but on Saturday morning when that video first showed up, I felt a pang of outrage, like so many people, and I hit the retweet button. Had I been at an outlet, I would have felt a lot of pressure to weigh in. I'm thankful that I didn't have to weigh in on this particularly. The only ways that I have talked about this are in a Twitter thread, which I thought about for a long time and actually wrote the thread out over a series of days, which is kind of unusual. And then things like this, talking in an audio medium, because I think that that actually gives you the ability to have nuance. You can hear in my voice that I'm struggling with some of these questions, that, you know, there's no definitive voice of God projection in that. That's really helpful in contentious and murky and treacherous situations like this.
Yeah, so would you have failed?
If an editor of any kind had put a gun to my head and said, we need something in the next 2 hours, this event is, you know, blowing up, there's an incredibly high chance that I would have written something that I would have regretted.
Charlie, I really appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Charlie Warzel, ex of BuzzFeed, is soon to be a writer at large for the New York Times opinion page.